wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland, Portland's listener-supported and democratically run radio station. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Course options and more information is available online at pugspdx.com. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kullberg is our engineer. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromise news media. Today on our program, Bill Resnick leads off with the first part of a three-part interview with Richard Smith, a China scholar, on how Communist China became a world economic and political power, able to challenge U.S. world supremacy, and thus fulfill its historical destiny as they see it, to lead the world. To read the obituaries, one might come to the conclusion that only good people ever die. All are beloved, and are the shining light of their respective families and communities. Denise Morris wonders how we can talk more honestly about the recently deceased, with a focus on the recent passing of former President George H.W. Bush. Concluding our program today, our newest Old Mole, Dan Jaffe, speaks with Professor Flavia Braga Vieira, Professor of Sociology at the Federal Rural University of Rio de Janeiro, about the recent election of an extreme right-wing government in Brazil. But now here's Bill and Richard Smith. Is China destined to become the new hegemon?
Hi, Richard Smith. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Richard Smith is a China expert, visits it often, teaches and writes many articles in the U.S. press, the left press, indeed, for the last 25 years. Today is the first of a three-part interview with Richard Smith. Today, in the first part, we'll discuss how China so quickly became a world economic and political power, now able to challenge U.S. supremacy around the world, putting the U.S. now on the defensive, in fact. The second part will explore whether to continue its rapid growth and ultimately succeed in surpassing the U.S., that to make good on its great quest to lead the world. That'll play next Monday on The Mole. Finally, on the 24th, 2 weeks from now, Richard and I, Bill Resnick, will examine China and the environment. That is, can and will China deliver on its promises to move quickly to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and save the planet? Well, never say never, but I think we're in for a really troubling period. Richard, let's start with the big picture. What happened after the 1949 communist-led revolution? Why, after 30 years, did the Chinese Communist Party, why did they go into state capitalism? And how did it achieve the incredibly rapid growth that's given them the capacity to challenge the U.S. for King of the Hill?
Okay, so, you know, Mao's revolution established, united the country, and he kicked the imperialists out. He set up a national industrialization program, 5-year plan, the model on the Soviet Union and so forth. And they had quite a high rate of growth in the 1950s and 60s, but they had very stagnant productivity and very slow growth of productivity. And to get production, they had to add labor and add means of production. And the more they added, the greater the growth rate went up. But it was a very inefficient way of growing. And so Chinese factories were massively overstaffed in the 50s and 60s. You know, in those days, like a friend of mine, Chinese guy, said, you know, if you worked in a factory in the 1960s, life was pretty easy if there was no crazy campaign going on, because there were so many people working. You know, they took tea breaks, and, you know, it was pretty easy, really, for industrial workers. The farm sector, that was different. It was harder, much harder life there. Okay, so low productivity, and they were falling behind, technically behind the West. So after Mao and his crazy campaigns were over with, they brought back this capitalist rotor Deng Xiaoping and the market reform people who introduced market reforms and opened the country up. And this month, December, this is the anniversary, the 40th anniversary of the great Central Committee meeting that inaugurated the market reforms. And so people probably have a, you know, a broad sense of what they did. They, you know, they freed up agriculture, and they said to the peasants, okay, I said, we'll abandon the communes, and you can work on your own, and you still have to produce a certain amount of key crops that they mandated production for, like grains, rice and wheat and corn, and also cotton and flax oil seed crops. Those they had mandated quotas still in those. But they said, so you can produce those, but over and above that, or on the side, you can grow fruit and vegetables, you can raise chickens and pigs and whatnot, you can sell that all on the side, we'll reopen the markets, and you can make all the money you want on the side. So you just give us a quota production, and you can produce all that stuff on the side and get rich. And that's exactly what happened, at least for a while. In the mid-80s, from the late 70s to the mid-80s, China's agricultural system boomed. And production took off, productivity took off, and all these markets sprung up, and people's variety of food increased dramatically, and people's income, rural incomes.
Yeah, the state had to though create some sorts of fertilizer and mechanization program happen.
Some areas of China's farming are more mechanized, like on the plains in the north where they grow wheat and so forth, but not in the small farms and the family farms. Those are still, unfortunately, still largely not very mechanized even today, with the small farms in the south and so forth, rice cultivation and so forth. They're hard to mechanize because they're not big-scale farming. But that's changing a bit here and there, too. You know, there's more and more industrialization right now, a big push now to do that. But the main thing was industry. In industry, the problem with the industry was the state has a plan. The state wants to develop certain industries, and so they would not let the state five-year plans be abandoned. So they would not let state industries produce for market completely at all, really. In the beginning, they hardly produced at all for market. They gave the deal that Deng Xiaoping gave with the state industries was that, okay, you guys make a quota that we want you to make a certain amount of steel, ships, whatever we want you to make, you'll make that. And then on the side, you can produce products on the side. So much like what they did in agriculture, they said you can produce stuff on the side and sell it. And so they did that. But in the 1980s, they never really freed up prices and markets very much. Like labor was not freed up in capitalist terms in those days. Workers still largely had their iron rice bowl in the 1980s, and they couldn't be fired. So in the state industry, I should say the one other aspect, the key thing about China's growth, that's what I'm talking there about, the domestic economy, the agriculture and industry. But the key thing that powered growth in the 1980s, of course, was the opening of the special economic zones what had been the former treaty ports in along the coast, especially Shenzhen, which was a fishing village of 30,000 people in 1978 and now has, I don't know, 5 million or something. Those places, they were kind of modeled on the special economic zones in Taiwan and so forth. But what they did was they attracted Western investors to bring in technology and new production methods and new products. They put them together with Chinese state investors, like partnered with state firms to create industries. And they also let them work with free rising would-be capitalists in China, that is, free people in the free market. So that sector powered China's growth, and it's largely considered to be a capitalist free market sector. I have this great cartoon in my chapters in my book, the first chapter. It has a picture of Deng Xiaoping standing there with a protest sign, and it says "Free markets, not people." And that's what he did. He had free markets there, but what he ran was basically a coerced, I'd go so far as to say a semi-slave labor system in the special economic zone, because they were exceedingly policed. They were militarized, highly militarized factories, you know, like these big factories, pretty, you know, like Foxconn and so, they have barbed wire around them and militarized, regimented kind of production. Trade unions are barred, any kind of worker organizations barred, a real totalitarian environment, and workers who tried to organize trade unions were immediately crushed and jailed and worse, you know. So what's interesting about China's takeoff is that compared to, say, India, which is just a completely hopeless case, you know, the Indian state can't even provide toilets or the garbage picked up, you know, let alone with the Chinese state, the bureaucratic state, was systematically organized to create ports and rails and infrastructure to support industrialization. They provided all of this stuff. Eventually, they provided more universities and technical institutes to train workers, staff, engineers, and so forth like that. And they created the internet, and they created high-speed trains. They created a whole mass of infrastructure that was perfectly suited, mated to the needs of the capitalist developers, export developers. The combination of that and a super suppressed workforce, cheap labor, masses of peasants, peasant children of peasants especially, flowed into those export cities in the 1980s to escape the poverty of the countryside and the overstaffing and, you know, lack of work out there and no way to make a living. So they fled into these special economic zones, and they were frankly happy to be exploited, because even at the low wages they were paid, that was much more than they were getting in the countryside. And it was a city. They were, you know, lots of young people leave the country everywhere in the world. You know, they want to get out of small towns and the rural areas and move to big cities. So they did that.
This is KBOO Radio 90.7, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, interviewing Richard Smith, a China scholar. So far, we've discussed China's early development after the Communist Revolution. A lot of growth and the iron rice bowl, that is, everyone had secured jobs and had food, which was a decided improvement for most Chinese at that time. But then the Chinese economy after that achievement turned stagnant. The remainder of this part one of our three-part interview, the remainder discusses the last 40 years, how the Chinese Communist Party with police state power maneuvered so that China became the manufacturer for the world and then got in position, as it is now, to challenge the U.S. for world supremacy. I think important was also the world capitalism at that point was going into crisis. That is, the competition was getting great, and especially many U.S. firms are getting outcompeted, and they had to find a way of lowering their labor costs if they were going to compete with all of these other companies. And they sort of ran the government. The Reagan administration took power at that time. The unions were weakened and further weakened. And those companies had just a complete sort of freedom to move their plants overseas. And there was China. The Chinese took advantage of that, right? And they were beckoning and offering everything. And this industrialization process just accelerated, it seems to me. But it's partly because there were these markets all over the world that social democracy had developed. There was high-consuming middle classes and professional classes in the West who were sort of hungry for goods of various kinds, and the Chinese then became the producers, because the companies, manufacturing companies, many of them opened Chinese parts plants or full assembly plants.
Right. There were a number of innovations and new practices. There were these that made possible the transfer of production overseas. First of all was computerization in the 1980s. It made it possible for companies in New York or Detroit to communicate with producers in Shenzhen or halfway around the world. So there was computerization was a big factor, and also the parcelization, the breakup of work, so that you could have specialized producers making different parts for a computer or a car in different places in the world, and even competing against each other, getting the same part made in Mexico and also in China. So you get them competing against each other to supply the parts. So the parcelization of production and computerization, those were the things that opened up the possibilities of offshore. And before, you know, the U.S. had been offshoring the auto industry to Mexico, for example, close by before that. But what made it possible to do it in Asia were these technical advances. And then, of course, the internet in the 90s, that really accelerated things like that. But then the question is, well, why China and not India? Because there were at least as many hungry Indian would-be workers, farmers, ex-farmers, who would love to have worked in factories, American factories. But the Indian state is so incompetent and unorganized. They could not provide the infrastructure. They can't even provide infrastructure for the Indians, much less for foreign investors. So they couldn't do this. But the Chinese is a hyper-organized bureaucratic state that could do this. And also because they're a police state, they could just tell a village, you're clearing out of here tomorrow. You people all have to move off your land. We're going to build an export zone right here. You know, you can't do that in India because you'd have peasant riots and you have fights and you have courts. They have a problem in India. It's called democracy. So that's why they have their trade unions. So you can't do that in India. But in China, they didn't have any of that. The state government could just come in and just cleared millions of people off the land to put in rails, ports, new cities, new industrial zones.
Hydroelectric.
The state could just command by fiat that this be done. And people were forcefully moved off the land, and then they developed it. What I argue in my book is that the key advantage here for the Chinese in the 80s was the police state. The ability of the police state both to police labor to keep it super cheap and organize it and get the flow there and so forth, and also to create the infrastructure all over the country that was conducive and necessary for economic development and production and so forth in the special economic zone. That's the decisive factor that powered China's rise vis-a-vis a place like India, which is the only other place that had that many people, you know, a competent number of people, you know. Now, the Vietnamese right now are trying to duplicate that a little bit. So that was what powered the rise of China. It turned China into the workshop of the world.
Though police states aren't always capable of doing that. The Russian police state, which was at least as ferocious as the Chinese, but much less competent, it seems to me, it sort of fell to bureaucratic sclerosis and corruption and self-dealing rather than maintaining this sort of focus on investment. It's sort of a remarkable police state, actually, in terms of the discipline.
It is remarkable. It's an extraordinarily disciplined, it was an extraordinarily disciplined police state. But one of the huge advantages it had also was the diaspora of Chinese right nearby. That is, there were all these Chinese capitalists in Hong Kong and Taiwan and Singapore and kind of all over East Asia.
Once in Indonesia.
Indonesia, and so forth, who were hungry to get into the China market in the 1980s. And they spoke the language, and they had the family connections, and they had the political connections. So you had the synergy here of the state willing to provide what they needed, and these foreign capitalists who are Chinese themselves. That was what really bolstered Chinese development in the early 80s and mid-80s. It wasn't so much Western investors. It was Chinese investors. But from Taiwan and Hong Kong and Singapore and so forth, who powered the initial industrialization. So they were all capitalists with money and know-how and connection to world markets that the Chinese needed. So the Chinese state paired with them and gave them what they needed in terms of infrastructure and labor supplies. Russia had nothing like that.
This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Richard Smith, a China expert. We've been talking about the rise of China, the bureaucratic police state being, unlike many others in history, extremely efficient, and the various reasons that the Chinese state was able to force this industrialization. You can find Richard Smith's writing by Googling Richard Smith, China. You'll find many of his articles. This week was the first of a three-part interview. Next week, we'll continue with Smith discussing the future, whether China can keep up the rapid growth and make good on its quest to surpass the U.S. to lead the world. And on December 24th, we'll conclude the three-part interview examining China's growth model and the environment. The issue, can and will China deliver on its promises to move quickly to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and save the planet? Well, I hope so, but likely not. We're in for a very rough ride on this planet.
I love to get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone. Get you and keep you in my arms evermore. Leave all your lovelies weeping on the faraway shore. Out on the briny with a moon big and shiny, melting your heart of stone. I love to get you on a slow go over to China. All to myself alone.
That was Ella Fitzgerald and Joe Pass, A Slow Boat to China. This is KBOO Portland, and you're listening to the Old Mo Variety Hour. Dismayed by the bipartisan praise of George H.W. Bush following his death on November 30th, Denise Morris weighs the moral imperative not to speak ill of the dead against the importance and responsibility to speak the truth about the deeds of powerful public figures. Denise?
Thank you, Tom. Yes, I have been a bit dismayed, even though it seems this happens every time we lose a powerful and controversial member of our empire. But my dismay really is not with the media coverage in the mainstream press. I mean, it would be pretty redundant for me to talk about that, so I'm going to look a little bit more at something that piqued my interest as I listened to some of the left press. While the mainstream media is throwing out language like honorable, honest, noble, dedicated, strong, charming, loyal, American hero, great statesman, this is all pretty standard fare, and it has been a very bipartisan whitewash, including our Senator Jeff Merkley, who got himself unsubscribed from my email this weekend, which was a long overdue act on my part. I kind of edged a little bit towards the not so entirely mainstream media and found a post from NPR. I usually can only listen to NPR news for a few minutes before I catch myself clawing at my cheeks, but in a sea of praise, the headline, "Examining George H.W. Bush's Legacy, Flaws and All," it caught my eye. You know, the words flaw, it was joined by shortcomings in describing what we should also remember when assessing the legacy of H.W., and it kind of reads like an afterthought. He was a real great guy, but he did have some flaws. But for me, flaws are for regular people or even characters in a novel, not for what one writer pens blue-blood war criminals. If I had to attribute flaws to Bush Sr., it would not be pretty. The horrors of the Bush family legacy cannot be captured neatly as flaws or shortcomings. And the left press has been pretty busy detailing these atrocities via Counterpunch, Common Dreams, Dissent Magazine, HuffPost, sort of, The Intercept, and many others. Sadly, my true dismay over the reflections on H.W. and his legacy came from Bernie Sanders during a brief appearance on Democracy Now! Last week. Following an interview with Intercept columnist Mehdi Hasan on his uncompromising article titled "The Ignored Legacy of George H.W. Bush, War Crimes, Racism, and Obstruction of Justice," Amy Goodman asked Bernie to speak on the legacy of Bush Sr. I assumed that Bernie would try to avoid that most hallowed incivility and not speak too ill of the dead. My expectations were pretty low. Quote, "Look, he devoted his life in his way and did what he thought was best. He was vice president, he was CIA director, he was president of the United States. His politics obviously are not my politics, but what we can also say is that he was a very different type of Republican. He was a very conservative Republican, but I don't think anyone would suggest that he was a racist. I don't think you could suggest that the essence of his presidency was trying to do what Trump is doing, which is to divide the American people up. He was a conservative president." On the heels of Bernie's primary campaign issues with Black Lives Matter and questions surrounding his commitment to anti-racist politics, suggesting that George Bush Sr. was not a racist is a lead balloon, but it gets worse. On The Late Show, Stephen Colbert asked Sanders how quickly he would take back George Bush over Donald Trump. Bernie responds, quote, "First of all, let's not forget when we talk about H.W. Bush, he was a war hero. Of course I disagreed with him, but he was an honest man. He was a decent man. He loved his country very much. And you know, we wish that we could have a president who is honest back in the White House again." Now, I'm not sure that we've had an honest president in the White House ever. It doesn't really seem to flow with a job description. But I have no idea what possesses Bernie to cling to this line on Bush. Bernie, the icon for an emerging youthful left movement in the U.S., Bernie's been criticized of late for being soft on U.S. militarism as he leads an important congressional campaign to end the war in Yemen. Bernie's take on HW goes beyond civility. It's not just a politically balancing act from a politician with a lot to lose. It is an admission. In Bernie's world, George H.W. Bush can be a war hero, honest and decent, as he and the entire Bush family accumulated massive wealth as war profiteers. In Bernie's world, H.W. is not a racist, in spite of the racist election campaign featuring Willie Horton and his escalation of the war on drugs, a disaster for people of color communities. Trump is epically horrible. But have we lost our minds? The decency of a G.H.W. Bush acts as a smoke and mirrors, and his legacy should not be sanitized for any reason. Missing W because Trump sucks was just a joke, really. In his 2013 article in The Guardian, Margaret Thatcher and the Misapplied Death Etiquette, Glenn Greenwald wrote, quote, "This demand for respectful silence in the wake of a public figure's death is not just misguided, but dangerous. That one should not speak ill of the dead is arguably appropriate when a private person dies, but it is wildly inappropriate for the death of a controversial public figure, particularly one who wielded significant influence and political power. When a political leader dies, it is irresponsible in the extreme to demand that only praise be permitted, but not criticisms. Of the dead, nothing but good, say nothing but good." That's a translation from the Latin, and it indicates that it is socially inappropriate to speak ill of the dead. But that is exactly what Bette Davis did in response to the death of a rival actress, Joan Crawford. Quote, "You should never say bad things about the dead, only good. Joan Crawford is dead. Good." This is one of those alleged facts that looms large as a measure of cruelty when it comes to honoring those whose lives have ended. Bette Davis did not like Joan Crawford. She spoke her truth. And I guess in that way, she shares a little something in common with another truth-sayer, historian Howard Zinn. In the foreword to the 2000 book Original Zinn, Conversations on History and Politics, author and activist Arundhati Roy describes Zinn as belonging to, quote, "that most unusual tradition of academics, intellectually rigorous, but unafraid to take sides when it is right and just to take sides." Howard Zinn and Bette Davis may not have shared the same vision for a just society, but they both did resist the lure of a polite civility with the power to erase a petty feud or bury atrocities committed by H.W. Bush over an expansive career as a, quote, "public servant," deeds that are not just past history, but reverberate on into our present. Zinn wrote prolifically on the Reagan-Bush administrations, but I'd rather share here his thoughts on the importance of history told from the perspective of those who never benefit, in fact, suffer greatly from the cruelty and indifference of the wealthy and powerful architects of American empire. Quote, "History is important. If you don't know history, it is as if you were born yesterday. And if you were born yesterday, anybody up there in a position of power can tell you anything, and you have no way of checking up on it." Wednesday, December 5th, was declared a national day of mourning for the deceased 41st president. I did what I always do. I reserve my condolences for the families who lost their loved ones in places like Panama, Iraq, Nicaragua, and of course, here in the U.S., I reserve my condolences for those who lost loved ones to HIV and AIDS while the Reagan-Bush administrations refused to take action. For working families struggling to make ends meet, families who lost loved ones in endless imperialist wars, and wars on drugs, and wars on crime, and wars on poverty, everything is a war in this country, and we can't win because they are actually wars on people, marginalized people who are seen as expendable. This is the truth of the Bush family legacy. My praise? I reserve that for the radical democratic social justice movements, for all the time, energy, and dedication it takes to root this mountain down. Again, Zinn says it best, quote, "They're willing to let people think about mild reforms and little changes and incremental changes, but they don't want people to think that we could actually transform this country. I happily without hesitation, take sides because it is the right and just thing to do. This has been Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That was What Do You Know by the Buzzcuts, and thank you, Denise. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Concluding our program today, Dan Jaffe now speaks with Professor Flavia Braga Vieira, a professor of sociology at the Federal Rural University of Rio de Janeiro, about the recent election of the extreme right-wing Jair Bolsonaro as Brazil's next president, and its implications for democracy and progressive social movements in Brazil. Dan?
On October 28th, in a runoff presidential election, voters in Brazil elected Jair Bolsonaro, an extreme right-wing congressman who has praised the country's 20-year military dictatorship, spoken approvingly of torture, and has threatened his political opponents with jail or exile. While the election result had been expected at least since the first election round earlier in the month, it was nonetheless a real shock for many people both inside and outside of Brazil, who had been stunned by the rapid spread of far right-wing populism worldwide, and Bolsonaro is perhaps an extreme embodiment of this trend. His victory follows several years of political crisis in Brazil after a decade in which the left-wing Workers' Party, or PT, governed the country of over 200 million people, beginning with the election of unionist and former metal worker Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, better known as Lula, who governed from 2003 to 2011 and presided over a significant expansion in social spending and a reduction in economic inequality. Lula was followed in the presidency by fellow PT politician Dilma Rousseff, who governed from 2011 until she was impeached by Brazil's Congress in 2016 for alleged corruption, after which the unpopular right-wing politician Michel Temer assumed power. To help us make sense of what's going on in Brazil, my guest is Dr. Flavia Braga Vieira, a professor of sociology at the Federal Rural University of Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. She is also the author of a book whose title translates into English as From Workers United to the Globalization of Hope. Welcome, Flavia Braga Vieira.
Hi, Dan. Nice to talk to you.
Let's talk about who is Bolsonaro. Where does he come from? What's his history in Congress? And what interests does he represent, or what coalition of interests does he represent?
Bolsonaro is a retired military man who was elected for the first time in 1998 as a municipal councillor, and since 1991 has been a federal deputy for 7 terms. He, since as a parliamentary, has always been ultra-conservative. Especially, he has a great critic of any attempt to elucidate the crimes of the Brazilian military dictatorship. He protects and defends the military agents who were responsible for governing the country from 1964 to 1989 through torture, repression, death. So he's very a defender of the worst forces of our society. But since he had always been a deputy of little national expression, no one imagined that one day he would reach the presidency of the republic. He never approved any single law or project in the National Congress during the 27 years that he was a deputy. The interests and coalitions that he represents are very complex. The coalition that supports him is very complex. It involves some factors of the armed forces, some ultra-conservative parties, deputies and leaders of neo-Pentecostal groups, agribusiness, financial market sectors, and arms industry, among others. I think it's very complex.
What about Brazil's business elites, its corporate elites, and even international capital? I know that during the campaign, The Economist, other business press were accused of normalizing Bolsonaro, softening up or not reporting on his authoritarian tendencies. I know there were a lot of candidates on the center-right and the right who were running. Why did these interests, do you think, eventually settle on Bolsonaro as a candidate? Or why did they decide they could live with him? Why were they so determined to see the Workers' Party, the PT, defeated?
I believe that a good part of the Brazilian elite did not want Bolsonaro as a president. They had other candidates in the first round, but as he was the right-wing candidate, the only who managed to reach the second round of elections, today the entire Brazilian elite supports him. But we have here in Brazil a highly concentrated media sector that was supporter of Bolsonaro since the first moment. And internationally, I think that media were not approving his candidate. But I think that some major capitalist sectors were not really worried about Bolsonaro. I think it's more like media and progressive forces and center-wing forces. But the capitalist sectors, in fact, supported Bolsonaro or were not afraid of Bolsonaro. And the major support politically he has internationally is Donald Trump. The question is exactly the one that you made. Why were they so determined to see PT defeated? I think the Brazilian elite, since the middle of PT government, since around 2008, have turned against the government of Lula and Dilma Rousseff. In the beginning, they were more, some sectors were together with PT government, but then they changed it. They did everything they could to get out PT of the government. So in the presidential elections, they had to support the only candidate who had chances against PT. The other candidates of the right wing did not get even 10% of the votes in the first round. So they were very weak. So Bolsonaro was the only option. So our Brazilian elites, they are so retrograde, you know. Remember that we were the last country in the world to abolish slavery in the end of the 19th century. Then we have two long dictatorships for more than 20 years during the 20th century. So this elite, so retrograde, they simply did not accept the government of the Workers' Party. Bolsonaro was their last attempt in this fight against PT, in my opinion.
It's sort of ironic in a way. I know that people on the left were very critical of the PT governments of Lula and Dilma for making substantial compromises and working with Brazilian capital, perhaps against the popular interests or not going as far to the left as they would have liked.
Yeah, that's really strange thing, because during the first three mandates, first and second of Lula and then the first of Dilma, in fact, they compromised a lot of great and major sectors of our elites and cooperative groups. But as they lost support of some of these groups, in fact, in the fourth mandate, the second mandate of Dilma, it started to move against some of these forces. And this was the final battle. After this, the elites really decided to get them out of government, to get Dilma through the impeachment process out of government, and get also PT out of our political scene, because they needed to put many of PT leaderships in jail with the justification of corruption, because they really needed PT out of the political game in Brazil. I think that Lula and Dilma made good governments for the elites of Brazil. Good government in a way that our economy improved growth. I think that they made the political and economic situation in Brazil much more solid than we have in the past. So they were really good for business, for the needs of the elites. But on the other hand, they really did a lot for the poorest, which means that they put in process many projects that empowered the poor. So I think that this was not acceptable for this so rude and authoritarian elites that we have.
We've heard in the media many analogies being made between Bolsonaro and Trump, media calling him the Trump of the tropics. How appropriate or how useful do you feel like that analogy is? How far does it get us? And how would you label Bolsonaro? Is he a neo-fascist? Is he an extreme right-wing populist? Talk about those parallels.
I think that Trump and Bolsonaro have a lot in common. They present themselves as coming from out of politics. They claim for a liberal economic project. They have very strong discourse against the left and the popular sectors, especially minorities. Both use the so-called social media to talk with the people, and in a way they delegitimize the institutional politics and channels of the institutional politics. But I think that there are a few differences that are important. Bolsonaro is a military man from origin, not an entrepreneur or, you know, a businessman. The ideas of Bolsonaro, in my view, are less clear than the Trump's ideas. So I don't think that Trump project for the United States is so undefined as the Brazilian project of Bolsonaro. I think that this is very different in my view. I think that neo-fascist is a very good definition for Bolsonaro. The direct connection with popular masses, the use of violent discourse against minorities, xenophobic nationalism, these are characteristics of a neo-fascist, in my opinion. I think that is a good label to define Bolsonaro, in fact.
Who was Bolsonaro's base? Among which social groups did he have most of his support? Are we talking about, in terms of class, in terms of an urban-rural divide, in terms of gender? I know there's a growing evangelical church movement in Brazil, but where is the sort of Bolsonaro's base primarily located?
Well, he has very great support among middle-class sectors, middle-class of the big cities, of the larger cities of the country, and also has support from the poor in the south and southeast of Brazil, which are the regions more urbanized and industrial of the country. So a middle class all around the country, especially in big cities, and low classes in the south and southeast of the country. Bolsonaro did not win only among the poor of north and northeast of the country, exactly the regions and groups that received most of the distributed programs of PT. And these groups are people from the countryside and the peripheries of the more poor cities of the country. So I think that excluding this very poor group that really started to have a very more or less better life during PT government, all the rest of the country supported him. But I think that conservative groups among the elites and among the poor were crucial for his victory. I think that the neo-Pentecostal churches, called so-called evangelics in Brazil, they play a very important role.
My guest is Flavia Braga Vieira. She's a professor of sociology in Brazil at the Federal Rural University, and we're talking about the election of Jair Bolsonaro as Brazilian president and the aftermath of the election and what the implications of the election are for progressive movements both in Brazil and elsewhere. Let's talk a little bit more about the appeals to violence and the role of state violence. Brazil, as you mentioned, is a country that had a 21-year-long military dictatorship from the 1960s to the 1980s. What is the social memory of the dictatorship in the present moment? How did that play into the election, and how did he use his appeals to the military and the history of the dictatorship in the campaign?
This is very annoying because, we know that everything that happened during the dictatorship, we know that there were torture, there were assassinates of left-wing groups and people. But what happened is that Brazil is a very big country, very big population, and most of this violence against militant activists during dictatorship was not very clear during the dictatorship. It's different from Chile or Argentina, where there were so many murders, were so many people that disappeared almost everybody knew at that moment that something was going on. In Brazil, it was not like this. And it was very concentrated in some regions of the country, big cities, where the militants were more active at that moment. And so all the repression, all the violence against society that the state, the military state, did at that moment were not really open. And we did not have, since the end of dictatorship, any good and deep process of memory, of opening these archives and opening the information. It was very weak in Brazil comparing to other countries in South America. And Bolsonaro is using these ideas, the idea that torture is not a really big point or problem, because in fact some people deserve it. And the people in general, they really don't care about, because they think that they are not going to be tortured, or dictatorship just tortured some marginals and people that were doing bad things or robbing banks and this kind of thing. And I think that Bolsonaro uses this very good.
Yeah, Brazil is known widely for having some of the most vibrant and the largest mass popular social movements in the world. Some of the best known of them are the MST, the Landless Workers Movement, others like the MAB, the Movement of People Affected by Large Dams, the Homeless Workers Movement, a huge labor movement. What do you see as the implications of this election for the large mass popular movements going forward?
I think that they keep doing the kind of actions they are doing for the last 20 years. But I think that the government will try to criminalize these actions. I think they will try to put some leadership of this mass movement in jail. They have this tool to put some PT, some Workers' Party, in jail using the corruption explanation and justification. And I think they will use against the social movement, the big social movements in Brazil, they use another justification, which is a justification of the social order and against the violence. But I think that these groups are so solid that even if some of their leaderships are put in jail, they will resist. I think the groups will resist, because this is a very strong and solid movement organized all around the country, not only in one region, but here in all states of the country. And I think they will keep doing the activism they are used to do. But in the other hand, we'll also have a reorganization, I think, a reorganization of the left. Because in the last years, as we have a left-wing government, some of the support of the group came from the state. And now this group will need to find support on the society, on the mass, on the population in general.
Before we close, Flavia Braga Vieira, I want to just put the situation in Brazil in the context, the broader context of Latin American politics and Latin America's left movement. You know, a decade ago, I think you could say Latin America's pink tide, so-called pink tide, was at its sort of highest point. Left governments were in power across most of South America, part of Central America, ranging from radical left to sort of center left. And, you know, the defeat of the PT is just one of sort of many losses for left governments across the Americas, and the rise of the right in Latin America. How do you see the state of the Latin American left more broadly at this moment? And what do you see as the potential for its renewal?
Well, I think that what's going to happen in the next years will be crucial. It depends on what's going to happen, for example, in Argentina. I've been there recently, and I have a lot of friends in Argentina from the university, and there are very mass demonstrations in the streets every day in Buenos Aires and other big cities in Argentina. So I think that a Macri government, for example, will not be approved for a second mandate. I think that this resistance in Argentina can lead to a different government. I don't know which forces, but I think that will change more left than they have now, for example. I think that the Bolsonaro government can be a very bad government. So maybe we'll have in 1 year or 1.5 years a political and administrative crisis in Brazil. So maybe this can open a window for other left opportunities in the continent. And also we still have some progressive governments in other countries like Ecuador and Bolivia. I think these are still, I think that the left is still in the game in most of the countries of South America. I think that the more critical situation is Venezuela. I don't think that that government will end well. And I think that the pressure of the U.S., the U.S. government, and pressure of other big, important economies and countries in the world will lead to a situation that will be a lot of violence and a bad end on what's happening in Venezuela. But I guess that Brazil and Argentina are more important to make the situation more stable than Venezuela, for example. The possibilities for the left will still be open in the continent. I'm an optimist in this way.
Finally, to wrap up, given the election results in Brazil, what would international solidarity with Brazil, and especially solidarity with Brazil's social movements, with Brazil's popular sectors, with the poor of Brazil look like at this moment in time, in your opinion?
I think that would be very important. I think that international solidarity with militants and activists in Brazil will be crucial for the security of these people. For example, I think that we need to denounce any judicial process against activists of social movements. We need to protect professors and teachers, this kind of thing, especially because I think that these groups, social movements and intellectuals, will be important to rebuild the possibilities of a social protection state in the long term in the continent, in Brazil and in the continent. So I think that will be very important to denounce, to make some actions of protests in other parts of the world. And I think that also in some points it will be important that organisms internationally present their opinion about what's going on in Brazil. So this is important. This is important to have some institutions, liberal institutions, state, intergovernmental organizations, following what's going on in Brazil and presenting opinion about this. This will probably make some pressure against authoritarian possible actions of this government of Bolsonaro to defend activists and to protect the democracy. I think that most of the groups, organized groups in Brazil, are expecting this international solidarity.
I've been speaking with Flavia Braga Vieira, a professor of sociology at the Federal Rural University in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. We've been talking about the results of the Brazilian elections, the implications for Brazilian society, and what we can expect in the future. Thank you so much, Flavia, for joining us.
Tais com palmos medida é a conta menor que tiraste em vida, é a conta menor que tiraste em vida. É de bom tamanho, nem largo nem fundo, é a parte que te cabe nesse latifúndio, é a parte que te cabe nesse latifúndio. Não é cova grande, é cova medida, é a terra que querias ver dividida.
The song was by Zelia Barbosa from her album Brazil, Songs of Protest. The English translation of the title is Funeral of a Worker. Thanks to all of today's participants, Bill Resnick and Richard Smith on China, Denise Morris on the death of George Bush Sr., and Dan Jaffe and Flavia Braga Vieira on the new Brazilian right-wing government. That concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kohlberg has been our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view. That is, from the ground up. As moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show and its segments in a day or two on the website kboo.fm. Tune in next week.